Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast. I'm your host, Zach Fagan, and joining me today is the esteemed Matt Boyd of Boyd Contracting. Thank you very much for coming in. Matt, I really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
So first things first, just tell me briefly, how did you get into general contracting? How did you get into the design build industry in the first place?
My story may be a little different than some. I dropped out of college and moved to Los Angeles to be a rock star in 1988. I had long hair, and it may be a little different now. You can go into your local mart and you can see guys with all kinds of crazy tattoos and piercings and things. But 1988, if you had long hair, you were getting a minimum wage job, you know, and the only thing you could really do that wasn't minimum wage was construction. So I was a 19-year-old apprentice kid working in Calabasas on what were called custom track homes, you know, fairly nice big homes. And, you know, I was trying to figure a way to get out of construction so I could make a living playing music. Truthfully, and it's something that I have a feeling you'll ask me about, I was frustrated with my employment situations. I could rarely find a place that I enjoyed to work at. Construction, even to this day, tends to be a place where it's not so PC. It hasn't really evolved into the HR world that many employers now are, you know, dealing with. It's a little bit of the Wild West. It's a little bit of the tough guy show. And if you're not on top of the totem pole, you know, you might have some pretty rough days at work. So I eventually started working for myself, mostly just because I wasn't happy with my employment situation. And I had a good people skills. I was able to get work. I was able to find other tradesmen and kind of bond together. I didn't really have a vision that I would be a general contractor someday. I did painting, drywall, and finished carpentry. And I had, you know, a plumber friend, an electrician friend, and we'd refer each other work. And then when I got to be actually in my mid-30s, it was like, oh, okay, well, maybe music's not going to support me. Maybe this is really my career path. So I finally got my general contractor's license in 2003. And honestly, all these people that were my friends really became my subcontractors. I was the guy that could land work and could kind of pool all of us together. And I just, again, I didn't really know where I was going with it. And I just found that I had a knack for it. I was able to work with design people. I was able to work with clients and understand complexities of what they needed us to deliver, and then go back and work with the guys in the field and say, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do. And it just evolved. So that's really kind of how it started for me.
Wow, very cool. Yeah. You share a lot of similarities in your, the coming to LA story, and, you know, working in the music business, and then ultimately ended up doing something else. I think a lot of us have, you know, share a very similar trajectory, but that's interesting. Very, very interesting, way that you ended up in, you know, where you are now. So you've been in business since, officially as a general contractor since 2003. You know, what are some of the, more interesting projects and, challenges that you've faced, being the head of the company?
So it's one of the things that I learned to rely on, again, are my people skills. And so all of these jobs, and I came to some peace with it at some point where I felt like, you know, I could be managing a warehouse, or I could be managing some production line. It wasn't as so relevant about what the product was. It was more about how can I use my aptitudes and help us get from A to B. And so there have been all kinds of things that you learn along the way, and you don't even realize how much you've learned when it comes to whether it's dealing with the city and the city saying, no, you can't do it like this. You've got to do A, B, or C. And you're like, well, I want to do D. And and so you get together with your design team. You kind of start meeting who all these great resources are and say, hey, guys, let's put our heads together. How can we get here? You end up as you know, I've kind of risen and gotten into be where I could work with some really neat people. You get in the rooms with a lot of very talented design people, engineers, architects, interior designers, landscape architects, lighting designers, and then they've got client, hey, I want to bring you to this great client, and these are really intelligent people with very particular ideas of how they think it should all come together. And I've always been a person that's good at just getting in the middle of that mix and saying, okay, guys, here's how we're going to, here's how we're going to get from A to B. And it really breaks down that simply. I at this point, I've done all kinds of things that high-end residential contractors do, very large electrical services that I've had installed, you know, 1600 amp, three-phase services that you don't see on an everyday house that might have a 200 amp single phase service. Medium pressure gas lines is something I can really get into the weeds here, but your standard house is fed low pressure gas. Once it comes out of your gas meter, you might have a big chunky line that goes to your house, but when you see this little line that actually feeds the gas, it has to do with all the different pressure elements that are in those gas lines. And so when you build these really big giant houses, they'll actually go up to what's called medium pressure gas. And then you have to have your regulators and your appliances and all these things that go into understanding how to make a large property like that function. And I've worked on, you know, 5-acre historic homes in Holmby Hills with 50-some thousand square feet of living space between different guest houses and staff buildings and main residence and parking structures. I've worked on really amazing contemporary homes in Hollywood Hills and Malibu. All across the west side of Los Angeles is really where my bread and butter is. So, you know, like this is now 2025, so I'm really since 88, I'm 37 years in this business, and it goes by very quick. But every project, you come into something new, and really my mentor that I consider Rick Holtz, who I worked for 9 years, who is now getting ready to turn 81 in June, you know, he would say, hey, I learn stuff on every project. You never stop learning. And so every time somebody comes in with a new way to do it, he had the open mind to say, no, I don't need to tell you, like, this is the only way to do it. This is how we do it. You might have something new. I might learn something from you. We're constantly learning and constantly trying to grow. And I attribute him to a lot of the good quality skills that I've honed and developed. I think I had the aptitudes, but I learned a lot from that man.
Well, that interesting that you bring up Richard Holtz. That was my next question. Sure. Is, you know, what did you learn? You know, what are some of the key lessons? So, it sounds like he was absolutely a wealth, you know, of knowledge. What are some other, you know, key lessons that you learned, from Richard? And, you know, does any of that inform, you know, your kind of approach to either business or just how you do projects today?
Yeah. One of the things to know about Rick Holtz is that he graduated from USC Architecture School, I believe, in 1967. And I think he's a builder that approaches a lot from an architect's point of view. And I think that's been a great part of his success. I think architects really appreciate him because he understands where they're coming from. But he's also taught me, whether he realized or not, but he taught me to be a friend of the design team and you know, not an opponent. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll see that a lot in building the dynamics of building projects, where the design team and the build team are fighting with each other. Hey, I don't have the right plan. He didn't tell me the right thing. But when you learn to work with them, that, hey, we're all important parts of this team. I think that's a big lesson that I learned from Rick. And like I say, I don't know that he maybe even realizes that he was teaching that lesson, but it came off very clearly. He's an absolute gentleman. And I'll tell people, you know, when you get to these kind of high level of projects that we work on, you get to really work with some salt of the earth people. And Rick Holtz is one of those people for certain. I'll also say that I don't think he realizes this, but I use him as a reference probably several times a week.
Wow.
To justify something. Say, well, sure. You know, this is how Rick Holtz would do it. This is how I learned when I worked for Rick Holtz. And it almost is like saying, you know, I just consulted the textbook.
Right.
And this is what the textbook says to do.
Sure.
And so, yeah, he's garnered a lot of great respect. And, you know, I get the luxury of getting to wield his name around a little bit and say, I worked for Rick Holtz for 9 years, so I know how to do this.
Sure.
And people go, oh, yeah, shoot, okay, you really do.
Yeah, well, I know who that is.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Boyd's praised for dedication to craft and, you know, relationships with architects and other leading subcontractors. How do you cultivate those relationships and maintain a really high level of craftsmanship on every project?
Well, the relationship and the craftsmanship, right? So that's two different aspects of it. And I feel like now as you know, the owner and the leader of Boyd Contracting, I mean, the relationships are a huge part of my job. And so trying to stay in touch with people, trying to make new relationships, it's something that I enjoy. And I think that's part of, you know, why it's had this level of success. That's what's kind of helped me get through all of these 37 years. I don't go to meet people and shake their hands because I want to get something from them. I'm really fascinated meeting people like Eric Evans, and, you know, you just start to get an idea of who they are and where they come from, and you start to learn a little bit about them. And those relationships just naturally become, you know, I would call them business friendships. I don't know that I'm going over to their house on Sunday for their kid's birthday party or something, but, you know, you get a really good rapport and a good trust and sense with each other. And so I think it takes a lot of effort on my part to keep those lines of communication going and letting people know what we're doing and what we're looking for and what's coming up next. And it takes a while to get some of those doors open, but once you get those doors open and you don't let people down and you come through for them and you do the things that you say you're going to do, that puts you head and shoulders above a lot of other people, which is almost disappointing, but it's just the truth. And that's probably cross-platform a lot of other industries too, I would imagine. To the craftsmanship part of it, there's, you know, a lot of it just comes with experience of what the expectations are. And you get to the point at this point in my career where you see things when you walk into a room that other people don't see. And then if you're a person like me who started on the tools, when you watch another tradesman work and you see him, how he's using his tools and what he's producing with it, you have a pretty quick identity that, hey, this guy's really good. This guy really knows what he's doing. And even talking shop, you know, when they start saying things, I've had instances with subcontractors where they suggest kind of a shortcut to something. And I kind of make a mental note to myself. I'm like, you know, I know that guy can do this other stuff, but his tendency is to want to go to a shortcut. I'm not sure this is the right fit for the level of jobs that we do. We work for the very demanding client. You know, that's really our appeal, is that we understand what that means. We know how to deliver it. And so it comes with experience. You can't substitute that. It just, you got to spend a lot of time on job sites and understand what that means.
Yeah, indeed.
So
indeed. Yeah, you're right. The do what you say and say what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
Ethos.
Yeah.
Seems very simple. But
true.
it is avoided by quite a lot of folks out there.
It's not executed well. You know, I don't think people necessarily have bad intentions. They
sure.
don't think they necessarily say, hey, yeah, sure, I'll do that. But they don't know how to execute it. And another thing that I say a lot when I'm promoting the business, there's some other builders in town that are getting big projects, but they don't come from the sophisticated background. They come from a little bit more of the how can we take shortcuts. And in our business, I refer to those people as spec builders or developers. And I don't mean to say that in any negative way. I mean, they have their place in the market. They're trying to build product to sell it and turn a profit. And that's perfectly, justifiable. I wouldn't say it's irresponsible. It's just a different market than what I do. But I've always been in the part of our niche, part of our business that delivers a great product. And so those are just two different backgrounds. I don't think those other builders really understand how they're going to get to the end point of delivering a really high quality product on time, on budget, managing all those elements when they came from a different construct. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, makes sense.
Yeah,
indeed. So what was one of the more challenging, projects or just moments in your career that, that you had to go through, and what did you learn from that experience?
So the first things that come to my mind are blunders. You learn from your mistakes. And when I look back many years ago, there were a couple of jobs that were just painful and, almost embarrassing to talk about. But at the same time, I'm talking 2011, 2012, which was a whole different dynamic. I guess I would give myself a little bit of credit. In 2008, 2009, the economy just really took a dive. It did. And that was very hard on my business. And so by 2010, 2011, 2012, work was starting to come again, but it was a little more cutthroat. And so I'm landing jobs, trying to keep my guys working, trying to keep my subcontractors working. And then I tripped up a few times. I had a project in the Hollywood Hills that a famous architect named Fickett designed. And from what I understand, not too many people would know who he was. He didn't build great glamorous houses, but he built really cool contemporary homes that people who are in the design industry are like, ooh, that's really cool, right? And so this really nice woman had been recently widowed. She was an older woman. It had a flat roof. It had a lot of problematic things to it. And it had a roof that I had never seen before. It wasn't a traditional roof, and we see them a lot now, but it was my first experience. We'll call it a single-ply roof. It's something they do on more in commercial structures than they used to do on residential. But now there's brands like Sarnafil that we use all the time on flat roofs, high-end homes. But it's a product that's like a sheet goods. It's rolled out, and they heat weld it together with like an iron. And I had never seen it before. Again, this was 2010, 2011. So I called a roofer friend of mine and said, hey, will you come look at this? The story the client tells me is we've had problems with this flat roof forever. We had it re-roofed. It always leaks until we met these European guys and they put this special roofing product on, and it's just been fantastic. But it's been a long time. Now the house has structural issues. We have to tear out some beams. We have to open up the roof. And she said, I don't want to do any other type of roof product. So my roofer comes out and he says, yeah, I know what this is. And he gives me a spec and everything. And I turn it into the architect, and he puts the spec, the brand, everything on the plans. And then it's January, as I remember, January, I think, 2011, and we decide to tear the roof off. And mainly because I was slow. January is not a great time to tear somebody's roof off. And it's a house that has furniture in it. It's not like it's a construction site. And it starts raining, and we're desperately trying to protect this house. And I ended up framing a temporary roof over it. And, I was young in my career, and I'm just winging it and trying to figure out how do I protect these people's home. And then my roofer comes to me after he's torn off the roof, and he says, hey, by the way, I have to tell you, I'm not a certified installer for that brand of roofing, so I can still do it, but they just won't get the warranty. And I'm like, no. You got to be kidding me. I've got the roof ripped off on this house. It's winter. It's raining like cats and dogs. And And so here I'm embarrassed. No. I call the manufacturer. I need a certified installer for your product, which I'll plug Justin Ewart. His company is called Allied Roofing and Waterproofing. That's who I was introduced to in 2011. And I still do business with him today. So this is a guy that installs our product. And so they had to come in and price it and meet my budget in the middle of this project while we're replacing structural beams and everything in the house. And I was panicked. And it was actually my wife who said to me, she said, you'll figure it out. And she was like, what do you mean? And she said, well, you're the guy that does that. You're the guy that figures these things out. And I was like, well, I'm glad you have so much confidence in me. And honestly, we got the job done. ARWP did a nice roof for us. We got the house all put back together. We protected the house without too many losses. We had a little bit of water here and there, but we worked with CW Howe engineers. We came up with some ways to put beams together by their design that we were able to preserve the beautiful look of that home and put it all back together. It turned out to be a big feat that I didn't realize I was going to have to pull off, but, those are some learning experiences. And so when I got into the next home and somebody said, hey, I want a single ply roof, PVC roof, TPO roof, I'm like, hey, I've got a pretty good education on it now. Yeah. So, yeah, those have kind of been some of my challenging stories where I ran into things that I didn't expect I was going to have to do. But you kind of have to use your wherewithal and figure out, hey, who can I call? What can I do? What's the next step? How do we get from A to B? Is still this the same message, you know?
Yeah, interesting. So, interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, conversely, how about one of the more, you know, rewarding experiences? And did it shape your vision for the company in any specific way?
Well, so I'm thinking of two separate things for your question. One of the more rewarding experiences, the first big job that I did when I worked for Rick Holtz, I won't say the client's name, it was a famous celebrity couple, beautiful home in Beverly Hills, on 2.5 acres, 20,000 square feet. Was a New York architect and design firm called the Office of Terry Despont, and they had a beautiful design. And I think even when we started that project, the people at Richard Holtz Incorporated didn't necessarily see me as being the lead. They kind of sent me in as the first guy to get the project off the ground, but I became the lead. And I ran over 100 guys a day at that job site. And to your earlier point, we executed some really fine craftsmanship, traditional and even sometimes a little bit art deco. The millwork with brass inlays and leather elements to it and just all kinds of crazy details. A really classical home theater that DSI did was what probably, I think that was my second project with DSI. And that theater was published in one of the AV trade magazines. But to have accomplished that project on schedule, on budget, the clients literally hugging me on the driveway the last day I was there. And at a later point, we had a new employee join RHI, and I was able to get into the home through the staff there. I said, yeah, you can come and tour around and just forgotten, you know, all the little tiny details that we worked so hard on. And it was very rewarding to just walk around and say, man, we really did a nice job here.
We pulled it off.
This is a special project. And that kind of put me on the map in that company where, oh, Matt's capable of handling some bigger, bigger stuff. And then my vision for the company really went back to the same element of not finding an employment space that I was really happy in. After that, I went to another famous property, and I became an employee of Peter McCoy Construction. And Peter McCoy and Rick Holtz, in my opinion, are pretty much, they're the two dudes for Los Angeles high-end, you know, custom celebrity-type homes for the last, I don't know, 30-plus years. They've just, those two men really cemented themselves as being who you look up to and who you want to model yourself after. And the project that I was on with McCoy Construction was not a great project. Everybody was relieved to finally be off of that project. It was just not going well. But that was at the point where I think I was 55. I think I turned 55 when I was at that project, and I just felt like I'm not finding a home. I'm not finding a place that I really want to work in. And so from those experiences, again, I learned a lot. And about a year that I worked for McCoy Construction, and I met a lot of new contacts, new resources, new design people, new subcontractors. And I just kept seeing this vision of I can, you know, risk of sounding arrogant, I can do this better. I can take this to another level. I know the best people in town. You know, I can get the best superintendents, the best project managers, because they're really my friends at this point. They're mm-hmm. people, again, just like those early days when the plumber and the electrician were my friends. These are all my friends, and I can say, hey, guys, I've got a vision on how we can really be the next number one GC in this town. We can deliver great, high-quality product. We know how to run large budgets and large projects, get them done on time, you know, at budget. We know how to do all the semantics that go into that. We know all the people to do it, and it's just, let's go do it. So it was really in January of 24 when I got my first project out of the gate. I'd worked for McCoy until December of 23. And now we have 25 employees. We have, from all the little small projects to the more major projects, we have 18 different projects going. We have three kind of main ones that are in the $10 million to $40 million range. It's looking really, really exciting about the future. And I feel it from the people that are working with us that they feel the momentum too. They feel the positivity. They feel like they're in a good space. And, you know, we know how to do the hard work, and that's not really the hard part for us, but assembling a team that really wants to be there and believes in what we're doing and feels good about what we're doing. I think that's, that was really my mission, and that's what I was inspired to do.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank
do
you.
Good work and have fun.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, so there's going to be days where it's tough, but we should respect each other, appreciate each other, and help each other. You know, I trying to create a construct of an executive layer where we support our employees, not kick them in the pants and say,
sure,
work harder, yeah, you know? I mean,
the beatings will continue until morale improves.
It's funny you say that, yeah, because so Dan Hirschman used to say that all the time. And so Dan Hirschman was Rick Holtz's right-hand man the whole time I was at RHI. And so Dan is another great man that I learned a lot from. But, you know, on those days where we were all kind of down, he would say those exact words, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, obviously. Sure. But it's like, man, it just seems to come with the territory. You gotta take some beatings in here. And
you do.
And, you know, I try to create an environment where we don't have as much of that.
Yeah, that's great. So, that's great, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S., Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way, no tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
Well, switching gears a little bit,
please.
So we... clearly, you know, LA just went through a major, you know, disaster with the Palisades and,
yeah,
and Malibu fires and Altadena, of course. How, you know, it's unprecedented, right? So to ask, like, how do you approach the rebuilding process, you know, is kind of like, well, how are you going to approach it, right? We don't really have experience. I mean, We have experience with wildfires in Los Angeles, of course, mm-hmm, but not on this scale, right?
Yeah.
So we're in a whole new territory.
Absolutely.
Now, where we've,
yeah,
had to rebuild a little bit in the past. We've, yeah, had some neighborhood damage. We've some structure loss. Nothing to the tune of, you know, 8,000-9,000 houses here and another several thousand,
yeah,
houses there. So how are you approaching the fire rebuild process, you know, is there, like, you know, in terms of materials and logistics, you know, is there any specific way that, that you're looking at this process to try and, you know, do that differently or do that process better?
Yeah. You know, as much as people have kind of wanted to say, well, how are we going to do things differently? I haven't really seen, that much approach. Mostly I've seen the approach of, you know, let's get a lot of people, let's throw a lot of architects, let's get a lot of city staff, let's get the Army Corps of Engineers, let's just people. I just did a debris removal on one home in the Palisades. And not because I want to be in the debris removal business, but really I want to build the home for that client and other clients. I kind of wanted to get a feel for, you know, how's it going in there? What's going on? What do we need to do? And, you know, it's a little zany in there right now. I don't know if you've been in there recently, but I've been in there regularly since the fire started. And so I've just seen all these elements of, you know, how the trucks are going in and out and how people are mobilizing and what the steps are to what they're really doing cleanup right now. You're not really seeing a whole lot of build back yet. Which I had an interesting experience about 2 months ago when I was going to get the paperwork lined up to do this debris removal. The homeowner and I went to the recovery centers, and then they said, well, you got to go over to the building department, and that really wasn't right. And, you know, but we get over to the building department where we thought we needed to go on Sawtelle in West LA, which is kind of the main building department that would handle the Palisades. And, I know exactly where I am. I go here throughout my career. This is where I go pull permits. This is where I go talk to plan check engineers. You know, I know what's going on here. And so this client and I go in there, and it was on a Saturday. And I kept saying, "Why we can't go there on a Saturday? They're open. You know, it's special for this situation." There was probably 12 city employees working in there at the building department. And there was no people in there, nobody going in there for service.
Wow.
They're just, I think, you know, we're mandated, hey, let's attack this thing. Let's throw people at it. We've got all these people in here that don't normally work on a Saturday sitting at the counter waiting to process plans. And it was desolate. We're like, hi, everybody. And I said, geez, guys, thanks for being here on a Saturday. This is really awesome. But maybe it was a little too premature. Maybe it was a little bit politically motivated that, hey, we've got all these people here on a Saturday and they're doing everything they can. But there really wasn't a system, you know. And so now I'm seeing, you know, people just kind of trying to start, okay, get our plans together, get the historical plan sets from the city of what our property, you know, if there are any, some people are able to, you know, get those and start to use those plans to start to formulate plans on how they're going to rebuild their new home. I think it's pretty well common knowledge now that you're supposed to be fast-tracked if you put a plan that is very reminiscent of what your house used to be up to 10%. You know, difference in size change. So that's kind of the bar that they've set. I was also told about a month ago that they announced that preferential treatment would be given to projects that are going to be all electric. They're trying to promote people not using gas appliances in their homes anymore, not gas fireplaces, not gas stovetops. So I'm kind of hearing bits and pieces. But I really haven't seen anything that, hey, just get your plans together, get your contractor, no more flammable materials, make it all out of concrete or make it all out of steel. There hasn't really been a precedent for that. The only kind of precedent that I've heard being promoted kind of across the board is coming from, I think, really more the insurance company world that is saying, hey, you've got to keep vegetation at least 5 feet away from your house. Major trees have to be even further away from your house. And I think that is really solid information that will help to keep your structure from catching fire, is to keep some of those combustibles as far away from your house as possible. That's been about the only really solid information. So I will tell you that the home in the Palisades that you and I were working on right when the fire started is one of the few houses that is still standing there, which was quite miraculous. That house is built out of concrete. It's a poured-in-place concrete walls. It has foam insulation on the outside and the inside that served as the forms that they poured the concrete in. It's kind of a unique building style that you don't see here in Los Angeles very much.
Was that ICF?
Yes.
Okay.
And so
I didn't realize it was ICF.
Yeah, and then the floors, the basement, the main floor, and the second floor are all concrete slab. And that house, even though it had combustible materials on the outside, it had wood windows, it had wood eaves. It did have a standing seam metal roof, which is basically sheet metal, but every house around it burned to the ground. I mean, the temperatures were you know, off the charts. We had aluminum ladders in the backyard that just completely melted. So I don't remember exactly what the temperature is that it takes to melt aluminum, but there was an insane amount of heat happening all around that house, and the wood components did not combust. And myself and the architect, Jen Dunbar, on the project, her and I have basically felt like there was a thermal break created by that mass of concrete that we think just kept the temperatures from being so high immediately at the house and kept those wood elements from just combusting. So that house, for the most part, is still standing. It has a little bit of smoke damage that we're trying to mitigate right now. But that's something that I would think a lot of people would be talking about right now, about how can we build concrete houses. You know, concrete has its own, you know, carbon footprint dynamic, and it may not be the end all be all, but those things don't really seem to be being discussed as much as I thought they would. It's right now seems to be more focused on how can we get plans into the city. And then one last element that I've found that's pretty across the board, that's I know it's frustrating, and it's part of what's slow right now, is most people are underinsured. Most people, and I'm not an insurance agent, I don't know that much about the business, but it's starting to appear to me that when you go to an insurance broker and you're saying, hey, you know, can you provide insurance for me, and they've got to put together a package that you'll purchase. I mean, they're right in a business too. If they really sold you a package on what it would really cost to rebuild your house, you might, you know what, I think I'm going to go to a different insurance broker because that sounds kind of high to me. And so a lot of these people and people that just redid their policies last year are saying, yeah, you know, my insurance agent said, you know, let's value it at this. And then I'm telling them, yeah, you need almost double that to rebuild that house. And so it's a little scary in that when you drive through the Palisades right now, you'll see signage everywhere. All American Builders, Pacific Builders, you know, these kind of generic names of companies you've never heard of. And I'm afraid these people are going to come in and, you know, either promise low prices, or they're going to, you know, really do a substandard job, or they're going to whack them on the back end. Oh, sorry, here's change order, change order, change order. It's kind of ripe for, you know, not success.
Right.
And so I was really hoping that some other funding entity, be it government or otherwise, was going to be part of these calculations. How do we build this back properly? Because the funds just don't really seem to be there to put the Palisades back together the way it was. I've only found one or maybe two clients right now that seem to have insurance budgets that are almost close to what it would cost to rebuild their house. And so they're wrestling with, you know, what do we do? Do we go out of pocket for this? Another client told me recently, he said, even if I go out of pocket now, I can't get a new insurance policy. Nobody will write me a policy.
Right.
So if I take my funds that I've, you know, worked all my life to accumulate and spend them putting the house back together the way I can't insure it, you know, it's a high risk.
Right.
It's a high risk decision. And so I think those are more the kind of things that are really driving what's going on in the Palisades, more than it is about, hey, how can we build a structure that isn't out of wood, or, you know, how can we make it more fire preventable? It's just about how can we feasibly build and make some replication of what used to be here and a community that people want to be at. There's a big disconnect there still. So
yeah. Indeed. Interesting take. You mentioned, you know, there isn't really the kind of discussion and conversation around, you know, materials, that, you know, that maybe you were expecting.
Yeah.
In my experience, you know, I've traveled quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You go anywhere in the Caribbean, Mexico, Puerto Rico,
sure,
right? The structures are built out of concrete.
Right.
And the reason why they do that is because heavy rainstorms, hurricanes, high winds, right? These storms come through, bring a lot of moisture and a lot of wind energy, and they just blow stick frame structures to the ground.
Yeah.
They lift the roof right off, you know, the thing's gone. And you're starting from scratch again. And, you know, I wonder, you know, when are we going to learn to, you know, kind of build something that's more, you know, like the Chautauqua Project, right? That's resilient.
Well, again, it comes down to money.
Correct.
And yeah. So, you know, I have friends from Europe that say, oh yeah, you guys build here everything out of wood. Where in Europe, like you say, more concrete and steel is more common. But part of that reason is that we have that natural resource here. We have lumber, we have forest. And so it's essentially more economical for us to build stick frame houses in the United States. That's just the way it's been. And so, you know, changing that dynamic isn't just about fear of the house burning down or blowing down. It's about how do you make the dollars work?
Economic.
You know? How do you build this house in a way that if I want to sell it, I can get the money back for it? You know, I'll tell you another example. In the Palisades, I had talked to a really great structural engineer that I work with a lot, Bruce Resnick of Parker Resnick. And Bruce and I were talking about, I said, yeah, you know, this property in the Palisades, it's not buildable. You can't build a home on it. The ground's not stable. And he said, Matt, it's not that it's not buildable. There's a way to do it, but you might have to drill those caissons so far down to get into bedrock that it becomes financially undoable.
Right.
You know, the dollars, again, don't make sense. It would cost millions of dollars to make the foundation for that house, and the house wouldn't be worth enough to support it in the end. So it just kind of comes down to, you know, what makes money sense. And again, I think that's, I was interviewed on the Friday right after the fire on January 7. I was walking down Sunset Boulevard going to check on the Chautauqua House and some of the other things in the Palisades. And the TV crew came over and said, you know, who are you? I said, I'm a builder. Can we interview you? And, you know, I said that in that interview, I said, it's the money that has to get in place to really make all these things happen. And they asked me, you know, on the spot, how long do you think this is going to take? And I said, yeah, 10 years,
yeah.
Easy. I mean, just not all these people have the funds just sitting by to say, okay, can you be here next week and start doing things, you know, regardless of what red tape they cut through. It comes down to the financial part of that whole, you know, call it one large project. You know, how do you fund this thing, and how do you get people to invest that money feeling like I can get a good insurance policy, or I can have some reassurance that this is money well spent. And I don't think anybody's really address that. I don't think people aren't finding comfort. You know, I think there's maybe a few people that are just kind of hoping, you know, boy, let's just keep good thoughts and we'll build our home back. And we hope that it comes back together. But,
yeah, it's interesting that you estimate, you know, at least a decade.
Yeah.
I've kind of been thinking somewhere in that neighborhood as well.
Sure.
10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
And I would assume, that, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years from now, there will probably still be lots that haven't been completely cleared off or are otherwise, you know, haven't been rebuilt. They didn't get sold. They're just, you know, it's just a slab still sitting there.
Yeah.
I have a house in Northern California, and just north of, you know, where our house is there, in Santa Rosa, there was a terrible fire. And years after that fire, you can still drive through there today. There's still homes that, you know, they haven't cleared off the slab, nothing. They're burnt cars still sitting in the driveway.
That makes sense, though.
You know, because folks really don't have the money to do anything about it. And there wasn't an Army Corps of Engineers that came in to, you know, clean off every slab and remediate the area. And people are still living there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's wild. It really is wild what we're you know, what we're seeing. So, you know, after all this, you know, what hope, what message of hope can you, you know, can you kind of give, you know, folks after this, you know, after this disaster, is there a message of hope to be had, given where we're at and, you know, all the efforts that everyone involved is, is putting forth? You know, do you think there's a message of hope to be had in this situation?
Well, I see from our side of the industry, people genuinely wanting to help. You know, I mean, we are really a service industry, and, you know, we have empathy. We feel for those people. You know, some of those people are close friends. We want to figure out a way to connect the dots, you know. So most of us, at least in the part of the industry that I'm involved in, are actively, you know, thinking, meeting, talking, trying to find ways to help people connect those dots. The fallback for, you know, most people is that Southern California is generally a very good real estate investment. You know, if you can hang in there long enough, it's prime real estate. But the confidence is definitely shooken. You know, how do people find positivity, and how do they find the gumption to, you know, go forward in this stuff? And like you say, we're in a really unprecedented, you know, area here where none of us have ever been in something so devastating. You know, the Northridge earthquake, maybe I compare, was had a good amount of devastation, yeah. But maybe is not localized mass destruction. I think a little bit, it's just you have to find some way to have positivity, because otherwise it just, you know, how can you live, how can you live your life? And I think that's, again, the empathy that we all sense, that we all feel, that these people are just trying to find ways to put their lives back together. And, you know, we're all sort of on deck waiting to find out how can we help? How can we use our business to facilitate these people? And we just don't know yet. And so, like I say, with trying the fire debris, just kind of getting in there and trying to understand the little pieces, again, to get from A to B, how do we help these people? How do we bring in our business, our knowledge, our resources? My approach to success in there is just going to be the same business model that I have. I have, great subcontractors like DSI that I have, you know, long forged friendships with, that I could say, hey, Zach, let's go work on this project. And, you know, hopefully I'm out of the many projects that you have, I'm one of the priorities. And same with my plumber and my electrician and my roofer and everybody. Hey, guys, I've got a really, you know, good client here. I want to take good care of them. Let's go in there and do a good job. It's those people skills that are going to help us get it from A to B and get and come through for people. And I don't just think we're going to have to take it one step at a time. I don't have any great knowledge to shed on it other than what I've learned so far.
Yeah. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, Matt. I really appreciate you coming in. And, you know, are there any final closing remarks?
I just, right now in my life, I'm very proud of our company, Boyd Contracting Incorporated. We are at boydcontractinginc.com. I bring all those other great quality people along with me. I'm able to bring in, you know, the different engineers and architects and different, you know, business friends that I've forged these relationships with. My only closing comment is we're really here trying to be, you know, a good part of the community, be a good builder, hopefully, you know, we'll keep that positivity and hope it perseveres for all of us.
Yeah, rock and roll.
Yes, sir.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming in.
Yeah.
And, let's do some more good projects together. All right,
thanks, Zach.
Thank you.
Cheers.